Hello, I'm Casey Robards, and it is quite an honor to be invited to share with you today something I never predicted would happen. I have to admit that I'm resisting the temptation to eternally edit this. due to the fact that Renee said, "Can you have this done by such and such time?" And I think there's no more time to edit, so here we go. I have enjoyed being reconnected with New Covenant Fellowship. After first being introduced to the congregation, I believe through Christine Durr Chamberlain, during my undergraduate years at the University of Illinois. Earlier this summer, Renee and I were emailing a bit about one of the books that I read this summer. The book is called Rediscipling the White Church by David Swanson. And in this book, Pastor Swanson talks about the obstacles that white Christians have faced when confronting racial injustices and pursuing racial reconciliation. Despite many honest efforts toward this, toward diversity and inclusion, toward cross-cultural relationships and such, the white church has often not had widespread success in becoming less segregated, or even in many cases having a nuanced understanding of racial problems and racial issues. So I find this reality to be present in my own family. As many of you know, I am a Korean adoptee. I grew up in a white town in a white family. Along the way, I've had many different emotions and levels of curiosity about race and ethnic identity. As a child, I was mostly embarrassed and ignorant of my own cultural background. It felt like race was a taboo topic, like politics and religion. As far as being Asian, I wouldn't say that I experienced a lot of open hatred. Like some of the instances we're seeing now, recently one of my Asian music students was spit upon in the farmer's market in Champaign, which she feels was probably racially motivated. But what I experienced was a lot of name-calling, ostracization, people yelling things out their car window at me as they drove by, or often the feeling that I really had no voice, or the sensation that my voice didn't really matter or wouldn't be heard. I feel that most adults expected me to be compliant and mostly silent. Certainly the model minority myth was in effect during my childhood. I skipped kindergarten. I was already reading when I went to school. I never had any problems in school in terms of the actual classwork, but it was a confusing way to grow up. I escaped into books, into music, and sports, all of which served as therapy. As I got older, I became more curious, more bold, and eventually quite passionate about observing cultural differences, exploring identity issues, and trying to figure out how does all this fit into God's overarching story. Now, at the age of 44, I live a life that is somewhere between black and white. It's barely Asian, I guess that's a matter of opinion, and by God's provision, I've managed to just keep going. My own family has not been able or willing to accompany me on most of the journey that has to do with race, with the exception of my sister, who is a great listener and has been a real source of support by being a real friend. She is the one that sort of gets it. I have to admit that the reason this book by David Swanson resonates with me so much is due to the time I've spent in many different, both white and black churches. I came to what people would call a saving faith in an American Baptist church at the age of 12. I spent a lot of time with InterVarsity in college, and since then, I've been in white Presbyterian and Methodist churches. When I was in Urbana, I was a part of Canaan Baptist Church under Reverend B.J. Tatum for over 10 years. Now, in these COVID times, I've been Zooming with New Covenant Fellowship and also Reverend Harold Davis's church, Grace Fellowship in Champaign, and Reverend Kenneth Edward Copeland's church in Rockford, both of which are Black congregations. So today I will share more of Pastor Swanson's teaching and look at a lectionary reading about Joseph and his family, and along the way share more of my personal story. Swanson points out that when it comes to discipleship, it's usually not our mind that leads us to transformation. Instead, it's our desires, our loves, our habits, and our imagination. Communal practices over time shape our habits, and these practices are never neutral. Someday, I should make a list of all of the differences I've observed between Black churches and white churches. The way you and I experience life and the things that we expect in society or in the church, they come from how we imagine the world to be. Because white Americans usually have the option to live in a pretty segregated way, with few possibilities of interacting cross-culturally on a regular basis, much of white Christianity does not know how to view racial conflict or talk about racial history. This is coming from Swanson's book on page 20. Many white Americans are only vaguely aware of the history of racial inequality in this country, or they may think, well, you know, all that happened so many generations ago. White people haven't been taught to see the connections with the history of American slavery. And many fail to understand how wealth and opportunity and privilege are passed from generation to generation. Having a friend with a different cultural background doesn't mean that deep conversations about race are happening within that friendship, and I believe that's the case for many different reasons. What are the power dynamics at work? Who is doing the work of fitting in? And to which culture is the fitting into fitting in? A few weeks ago, Renee spoke beautifully about generational wealth and the effects of inequities over time in her teaching about Jacob and his family. Today, we'll continue on with Jacob's story. So there's conflict in this blended family of 12 boys. Leah had 6 boys. Rachel had 2. Remember, Rachel died in childbirth when Benjamin was born. Rachel's servant, Bilhah, had 2 boys, and Leah's servant, Zilpah, had 2 boys. Now, Joseph is Jacob's favorite son, the firstborn son of Rachel, his favorite wife. Joseph's brothers resented him. They were jealous of his dreams and visions of self-importance, and especially of the fact that Jacob openly gave him special treatment. One day Jacob sent Joseph to check on his brothers. When the brothers saw Joseph coming, they plotted to kill him. You could imagine how the idea grew from quote-unquote locker room talk and bullying to an actual plan to commit bodily harm. Sometimes well-meaning people might go along with a group because they may not see another alternative, or they feel like it won't matter if they speak up. The damage has already been done, or maybe it just doesn't seem like it's worth rocking the boat. Some people are willing to watch another be bullied in the workplace, for example, or they may even join in the bullying just to avoid being the target themselves. Reuben, the oldest brother, tried to intervene so that he could get Joseph back home safely. But Judah came up with an alternate plan when it looked like they might be able to make some money, because after all, they're brothers. And Judah convinced the others not to kill Joseph, but instead they trafficked him to a caravan of Ishmaelites who were headed to Egypt. Reuben was distraught, but together the rest of the brothers went back home and they lied about what they had done to Joseph, saying that he had been killed by a wild animal. Imagine Jacob's pain, and imagine the scene with the brothers faking tears and sorrow, hoping that their pact would remain, and that no one would slip up and give away the truth, or have their conscience get to them and confess. Meanwhile, Jacob was in Egypt and was climbing the political ladder. The Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Genesis 39:23. After 13 years, there was a famine in the land, and it turns out that the only people with food were those under Joseph's jurisdiction. So Jacob sent his sons to Egypt to buy food, and maybe toilet paper and Lysol wipes, if you get my drift. Joseph's brothers arrive in Egypt. They don't recognize their brother, who is now in a very powerful position. Maybe Joseph was immediately triggered when he saw them, or maybe he was keeping his wits about him and his emotional boundaries in place. He wasn't going to be taken by surprise again. Maybe he was thinking about revenge. He must have spent many hours wondering what it would be like to see his family again. It would be nice to at least let Jacob know that he was still alive. Joseph put his brothers through a series of tests. Were they willing to acknowledge what they had done to the 17-year-old Joseph? Had the brothers changed their ways? Did they also hate Benjamin? Would they be willing to lie to their father again? Was Benjamin in danger now? Judah was the brother who concocted the plan to sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites instead of killing him. But this time around, Judah makes a passionate plea. We cannot put our father through the same misery again. He takes personal responsibility to make sure all of the brothers return home. Judah even offered to stay behind if only the rest of the brothers would get home. So now I'll read from Genesis chapter 45. This is verses 1 through 15. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Send everyone away from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me." And they came closer. He said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son, Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not delay. You shall settle in the land of Goshen and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, as well as your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. I will provide for you there, since there are 5 more years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have will not come to poverty. And now your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my own mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father how greatly I am honored in Egypt and all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here." Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, while Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. This isn't the first time that Joseph had an emotional outburst. Joseph wept alone when he heard Reuben acknowledge what they had done to Joseph and that it was sin. Joseph wept alone when he saw Benjamin, his own biological brother. This time, he couldn't hide his emotion from anyone around him. His weeping was so loud. How many times are our Christian brothers and sisters weeping because of sin committed against them? It's a wonderful gift to receive permission from others to grieve, to be hurt, to express strong emotions and not be told to just get over it or some other cliche or unhelpful comparison. Sometimes we can be so uncomfortable with emotion, particularly some of us who are the more stoic European descendants, that we don't know how to handle strong emotion in our own families or in people of other cultures. Somehow feeling and expressing emotions is seen as shameful or unprofessional or even childish, but emotions connect us as humans and help us empathize and heal. Let me pause here and insert some of my own personal journey as a Korean adoptee. I was reluctant to share that much about myself, but Pastor Renee really encouraged me to do so, so I'm trusting her judgment. The truth is I probably could talk for days about being adopted and many of the ironies I feel on a daily basis. I relate to so many different things with a sense of nostalgia, for example. Grandma's home-cooked meals for me, that's fried chicken, biscuits and sausage gravy, garden-grown food, etc., etc. But there's a part of me that also feels like bibimbap, bulgogi, japchae, kimchi, kimbap. These are kind of comfort food to me also. The idea of home is a little complicated. One of the major ironies of being adopted is that this has shaped me to such an extent, but it was never my choice. It happened before I even have a conscious memory of it happening. I was flown to Illinois when I was almost 8 months old. I'm very accustomed with living with unanswered questions, as well as a certain lack of privacy. It's obvious when I'm with my family that I don't fit in. Sometimes the questions that come can seem invasive, kind of like when strangers comment on whether pregnancies were planned, or whether a woman plans to have babies, or more babies, or why they don't have any babies. I've gotten used to it over the years, but I find that one reason I like big cities is because I feel that I can actually be anonymous and avoid being stared at when I'm walking around. It's always strange to be aware that what I think about myself is hardly ever what other people think of me. It's exhausting. I think people who are biracial and multiracial may share some of these same feelings. Adding in the word transracial to the adoption picture does intensify the experience. So being adopted by a family of a so-called different race. Once when I was in high school, I think it was, I asked my mother, you know, what would she think if I married a black guy? She said, well, she would worry about how our children would be seen. She thought life would be so hard for them. She said this without thinking for a moment that life was possibly hard for me being transracially adopted. One of the hardest things about being adopted in general is that the universal belief and response is, aren't you lucky? You are special. You were so wanted. Your parents must be amazing. And other very happy thoughts. I am not at all downplaying the truth of these statements, but heard year after year, and minus any kind of acknowledgement that there was also abandonment, loss, an erasure of culture and language, connection to my actual homeland, and a forced assimilation in a place where assimilation is not ever fully granted to people of color. Well, it's complicated. To not know anyone who I am related by blood, maybe it makes the whole idea of family much more of a conscious choice for me. I'm not sure. To imagine being reunited with a biological relative of any degree of closeness is overwhelming to think about, let alone a birth mother, father, or sibling. So I say all this to say that I doubt that Joseph's brothers could completely relate to Joseph or understand him in the same way after he had spent his adult life and career in a completely different place and culture. Maybe his sense of isolation was only equal to his sense of divine purpose. I think that long-term missionaries or expats or military veterans may experience some of this when they deal with the culture shock after returning home. So for this reason, I like how Joseph acknowledges both sides of his own story. He says, "You sold me here, and God sent me." And Joseph is the one who says to his brothers, "Okay, I see that you're upset, distressed, you're angry with yourselves, and you have good reason, but now it's time to focus on God's purposes." It sticks out to me that the brothers didn't say, "Well, that's all in the past. Let's move on now. Don't let that bother you anymore. Let's not upset Benjamin with all of these details. Besides, look at how powerful and successful you are here in Egypt. It doesn't even really matter how you got here." There have been many people in my life over the years who have given me room to grieve, to heal, to process, to sometimes be hurt or angry, and, you know, just to acknowledge the painful side of being an adoptee. So even if my adoptive family is not capable of accepting that part of my story or talking about it that much, God has put other people in my life to fill this need. I also believe that part of the pain of being an African-American person in America is due to the refusal of many people to acknowledge or understand the impact of enslavers actually owning people, let alone how racism continues to flourish and be empowered. It's the same pain that Holocaust deniers inflict. It's the weapon of using conspiracy theories, such as the people that are saying that school shootings are actually a hoax or an attention-seeking political maneuver. After the brothers experienced this emotional reunion together, and I believe by this time there was probably not a dry eye in the room, then they talked together. I would love to be a witness to what they were saying, finally able to talk freely, the brothers without guilt, Joseph able to fill in so many blanks about his family. I wonder if he and Benjamin looked alike, if they had the same laugh. Did they like the same food, or did they walk with a similar gait? As an adoptee, at times it is a struggle to feel any sense of belonging just about anywhere. I have been warmly welcomed as a Korean by other Koreans at times, and at times I've been sort of dismissed. Most recently, the Korean government sent me 50 KF94 masks with a letter saying, "Korea has not forgotten you." It's a longer story, but at this point in my life, I often feel more kinship with the African American community than I do with the very familiar to me white spaces. Again, it's complicated. I may personally feel my own sense of being at home in Black spaces, but obviously other people do not always see me as belonging in those spaces. And of course, I respect that too. Well, getting back to this book, Rediscipling the White Church, Pastor Swanson says that white Christians often struggle to enter into the experiences of people of color. One example is that it can be hard to understand why people of color need to be among other minorities at times, just to feel safe, to feel unguarded and free to just be. There is a feeling of safety when I'm in someone's presence who I know, you know, they just get it. They believe what I'm saying. They're not going to argue with me, question my perception, or discount my story. They've probably already lived through many trials and have years of survival strategies that have been passed down through generations. I realize that most people of color have family members that represent this safe place. For me, I've had to find most of my safe places outside of my adoptive family. It's my hope that the church is a place for people to experience this safe place, to experience healing, and that the church is a place where people have a maturity when it comes to dealing with race and racism. However, I have to say I've experienced a lot of immaturity in white churches as it relates to race and culture. Forgive me if I get a little academic here, but Pastor Swanson lists three types of thinking that often have tripped up many white churches in their pursuit of racial reconciliation and shared governance, hopefully, with minority leaders. The first is the idea of free will individualism. This is having an attitude that downplays the importance of institutions and raises the importance of personal accountability. This causes white Christians to almost exclusively appeal to the need for personal responsibility and hard work. I've been thinking lately about how many of our hymns emphasize the individual relationship with God. My Jesus, my soul, Jesus walks with me and talks with me. He lifted me, he leadeth me, he touched me. Jesus loves me just as I am. You know, I love all these hymns. And of course, the personal touch, the personal word, and the personal love from God and for God is paramount. And I realize there's often a communal understanding of me, myself, and I in many of our songs and experiences with God. So when we say I, we might mean we. I do think that New Covenant Fellowship is pretty aware of the power and influence of individualism in our culture. David Swanson conducted an interview with two people, Randy Woodley and Lenore Three Stars. I'll post the link to that interview in the written transcript of this message today. Randy and Lenore both talk about the concept of shalom, and they explain how an indigenous worldview is different from an individualistic worldview. It was a fascinating interview. In New Covenant Fellowship, we may not have thought as deeply about individualism is actually perhaps a trait related to white culture. I'm not sure if most people who are part of New Covenant would call New Covenant a white church, but I would guess that people of color would definitely perceive New Covenant Fellowship as an extremely white church. So Swanson's second point about what has made it difficult for white churches to understand racial issues is the idea of relationalism as a value. Seeing sin as something that prevents us from a relationship with God and Christ as a bridge back to a loving God, we may be inclined to see many problems as a reflection of broken relationships. If this is our lens, then friendships between blacks and whites, also Asians, Latinos, I'm so used to things being black and white sometimes in the language that it's refreshing when it's not just that. But these friendships become the priority. Do you wonder how and why it still remains true that many white Christians do not have any or many close relationships with anyone from a different racial or ethnic background? Achieving meaningful relationships is a good thing, is a great thing, but often minorities feel like tokens in white communities where white people are still in charge and white cultural norms are seen as everyone's normal. Just last week, I was asked to be in a marketing video, and I had the sneaking suspicion it was because I was Asian. At the moment, the only non-white person in this particular tennis community. If the organizer had been upfront and told me that that was the main reason they wanted to include me in the video, I might have felt more comfortable about it. I'm not sure. In the end, I decided I didn't want to be featured in that way. It feels like the community is not actively trying to be more diverse. They just want to appear to be more diverse than they are. They want minorities to feel welcome, but getting the community to do something a little deeper is another venture. So Swanson's third point is anti-structuralism. This attitude focuses attention away from unjust social structures and shifts the guilt back to the individual. White Christians are often skeptical of the language of social justice, feeling that any attempt to work towards systemic change is a threat to personal faith. Often, this results in openly racist people or actions that are scapegoats and seen as really the real problem, while racist structures and traditions remain in full operation. I believe that New Covenant does know that structures are problems. I believe when it comes to issues such as voting rights, immigration, access to education, redlining and housing issues, homelessness, healthcare, many, many, many things, New Covenant has had over the years many passionate members who care deeply and have been actively involved. But I will gingerly say this, sometimes it's hard to see our own structures and systems that we put in place. It's hard to see culture. It's invisible, as Renee said a few weeks ago. Over time, these structures and cultures become traditions and become our way of doing things. There's nothing inherently right or wrong about most of these patterns, but just to play devil's advocate here, how does it play out that there were white pastors, white worship leaders, and musicians leading the meetings in the early days of New Covenant Fellowship? Imagine if, for example, that for 25 years, the worship was led by a black gospel musician who played Hammond organ instead of guitar. What if all the singers and instrumentalists in the early days came out of the black gospel tradition? How might the demographic and worship style of New Covenant be different today? When I came on board at New Covenant as the worship pastor, one of the goals at that time for having me be involved was to introduce more multicultural music. But you know, even in doing more gospel songs or things like that, I found myself constantly needing to accommodate white cultural norms, such as transposing the music to guitar-friendly keys, pre-arranging how many times will we sing the chorus and verse and repeat it and go back to the chorus and will it be two times or three times, and performing the songs without a call and response type of soloist or without an actual choir, and in general, making a lot of adjustments, you know, because of expectations that people had about worship. I say all of this not to judge or be critical of what we did at that time or at any time in New Covenant's history. I'm only pointing out that singing black music carries with it an aesthetic, just as does black preaching and a black church service. Singing a gospel song is not really authentically possible unless a critical mass of people understand all of those intangible and unspoken cultural markers. On the Zoom calls with this church in Rockford, I've gotten a real kick out of the pastor's been doing some messages outside, and some people are listening from lawn chairs and in their cars. And instead of shouting amen and you know, being vocal, they're honking their horns to get across the same kind of agreement. And I think it's hilarious. And at first I thought, what is happening? They're all honking at him. And I was, oh yeah, that's what's going on. So by now you probably realize that I'm not going to offer any grand solutions in this, I guess I will say, teaching. I apologize if it feels like I'm calling attention to things and then just leaving them sit out on the kitchen table. Pastor Swanson does offer several ways forward for churches who want to grow in the type of discipleship that challenges racial views and habits. I'm not really sure that there's one answer or one model for any church to follow. Now, the truth is, again, it's complicated. There are no easy answers or quick fixes. And frankly, there's an exhaustion that comes even from just being aware of all of the disparities and inequities in our society. So in closing today, I'd like to emphasize that I'm so grateful that our New Covenant Fellowship family is willing to grapple with these kinds of things. It's enlightening to hear Ron and Jeff, Kevin, Grace, Renee, and many others speak in their own ways. I'm incredibly encouraged by how New Covenant tries to embrace contradictions and let things be complicated at times. So I thank you for listening to a small bit of my story. I hope that I've opened a way for you to reconsider some things and in general be energized. We're all in this together is something that we've heard said a lot lately. And I think the fact that we're all pointing in the same direction, wanting the same kinds of things, is life-giving in and of itself. Being adopted is both wonderful and painful, and I'm okay with that. In the end, it's not my story, it's God's story. It's okay that it's messy, like this oil spilling down Aaron's head, beard, and clothes in Psalm 133, which is also one of the lectionary readings today. I'm going to finish with that. Psalm 133, how very good and pleasant it is when kindred live together in unity. It's like the precious oil on the head, running down upon the beard, on the beard of Aaron, running down over the collar of his robes. It is like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord ordained his blessing, life forevermore.